Good morning, everyone. The signs are everywhere. Rising civilian death counts, rising casualties on both sides, calls for a cessation of hostilities at the UN and around the world, and even the rollout of graphics calling for another crisis or describing another crisis in the Middle East on cable news networks around the world. But it looks as though the crisis between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is going to go on for some time. No sign of any cessation of hostilities. And to discuss both what's going on in Israel and Gaza this morning and what the reaction is in the region are Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times, who joins us from Jerusalem. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
And from the BBC, Jim Muir, the Beirut Bureau Chief for the BBC. Jim Muir, thanks for being with us.
Most welcome.
Ethan, let's begin with you. The talk of humbling Hamas and destroying its lethality seems to be the theme of statements coming out of the Israeli government this morning. Is there any indication of a threshold that might cause them to declare this a military success in some way? Or is there a specific military objective in that you've been able to decipher?
I'm afraid that it's unclear. I don't think that there's any talk of a slowdown or a stop. This is something that they have had in their pocket and been thinking about for many months. And, you know, it's constant reference to the 2006 war against Hezbollah, and it's important to remember that for outsiders and certainly for the Lebanese, what was most distinctive about that campaign was Israel's level of aggression, that it was extraordinarily high. In Israel, the opposite view is held, that the failure of the Lebanon war in 2006 was a result of its restraint. So therefore, the view here is that they are not going to show restraint, that this is going to go on for some time.
What are the differences, though, in the battlefield? I mean, we talked to your colleague yesterday in Gaza who was describing the impact of this so-called targeted bombing campaign in one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And we're not talking about the hills of southern Beirut in this kind of a campaign.
Well, actually, southern Beirut is extremely densely populated, and I think when you talk to Jim in a minute, there is no question that there were an enormous number of Lebanese civilian casualties in 2006 as well. They're very similar situations in the sense that these are guerrilla, quote-unquote, people's armies, in many ways impossible to distinguish from the general population. Today, for example, in Gaza City, there was a bombing at an apartment in a building just 100 meters from my colleague where she was sleeping. So, you know, it's all over the place. It's very similar to what was going on in southern Beirut.
Jim, how would you describe the similarities or differences between what happened in 2006 and what's going on now in Gaza?
I think you're right to suggest that Gaza is more densely populated. A lot of the trouble in 2006 affected south Lebanon as opposed to the southern suburbs of Beirut. Obviously, when they hit the south of Beirut itself, that is very densely populated, although people knew it was going to happen, so they cleared away from potential targets. But a lot of the casualties were in the south, where buildings were knocked down in villages and towns throughout the area. But it is a much more dispersed area, so it's going to be much harder for them to use that kind of air power in Gaza without killing, I think, proportionally a lot more people than were killed in general in South Lebanon as a whole. I think there are a lot of similarities. Obviously, main one being, I think, that despite Israel's awesome air power, it can't really hope to get to the root of the problem with air power alone. It will have to go in on the ground, and it may even have to stay in if it's actually to clear up, because nobody believes Israel won the war in 2006. Hezbollah is still in a position to fire rockets. Hezbollah is still there. If Israel had intended to root out Hezbollah, it certainly failed.
And so that certainly begs the question, what would Hamas consider a victory? What is success to them, Ethan? Is it Israeli troops coming in on the ground?
I think in some ways that, yes, it is at least a measure of victory for them, because you can't fight against air power. You can't stop them. You can't take your pound of flesh. When you have Israeli soldiers in front of you, you have a chance of fighting back, and that's certainly what they're hoping for on some level. Like Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, there are a lot of tunnels and a lot of sort of byways that they have worked out in preparation and waiting for this ground offensive. But I think that, again, what would be a victory for them would be simply to be still standing when it's over and to have seen to have withstood and acted as leader of the resistance against the Zionist oppression.
But Ethan, not meaning to sound argumentative, that would be the opposite outcome of what Hezbollah achieved in Lebanon, where the Israelis actually withdrew. In this particular case, they would yearn for an actual reoccupation of Gaza as some sort of military victory?
No, I don't mean a reoccupation. I think a rather similar situation, which is that after some weeks, there would be a deal where Israel leaves. I mean, Israel, again, that's what happened in 2006 in Lebanon, and Hezbollah was still standing. I mean, Israel argues that it wasn't such a defeat because there has not been a single rocket that has come into Israel in the 2.5 years since. That's what it claims all it's looking for from the situation in Gaza.
Jim Muir, here is the sound of some protesters in Damascus as there's been reaction around the world of to what's going on in Gaza. Listen to this. In some sense, Jim, the reaction is not surprising at all, but is there any sort of character of the waiting game in the Arab world as they take a look at what's going on in Gaza?
I think that there is quite a lot of popular sentiment rising, and I think Arab leaders are getting wind of that. Egypt, for example, here in Lebanon, Hezbollah has staged a couple of big rallies and some fiery speeches. I think that the key question really is whether Hezbollah feels eventually pressured by its own ideology, in a way, to do something, as it did indeed in 2006, that could provoke a conflict with Israel, between Israel and Lebanon, because that's what happened in 2006. They staged that cross-border provocation, took a couple of Israeli soldiers prisoner, precisely in order to relieve a very similar Israeli pressure on Gaza. So they must be feeling that pressure internally, at least. A lot may depend on what decisions are taken in Tehran, because according to some senior ex-Hezbollah officials, it's Tehran that calls the shots when it comes to decision-making inside Hezbollah. That's certainly some view, a strong view. So I think, the longer this situation goes on, the more dangerous it will get.
Well, then here's a question for both of you, and I'll begin with you, Jim. Is there anybody on the regional stage or even in the sort of traditional group of brokers of Middle East peace that is capable of doing what seems to be at the absolute minimum what is required for some sort of diplomatic outcome here, and that is to create a unified Palestinian front to negotiate with Israel? Anybody capable of producing that kind of a consensus among the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza?
That's very difficult because it is so fragmented, and in a way American policy is being seen writ out on the ground here, because the Americans did not welcome the election of Hamas in Gaza in 2006, and obviously have been doing everything they could to try and bring Hamas down. So it is a situation where the obvious brokers, the Americans, are not in a position to do that brokering, and that is the big issue, really. Who is capable of pressuring Israel to kind of scale down its operations? Who is going to get some deal brokered with the Palestinians? That could be an Egyptian role, but the cards have to be in the right configuration for that to happen. One interesting point from a British point of view is that the British are not following the Americans blindly, as they did in 2006, where Mr. Blair was not calling for an immediate ceasefire. The British are now calling for an immediate ceasefire. So the US is really out in the open as the only power, just basically blaming Hamas and saying to the Israelis, get on with it.
Yeah, it's hard to hear a quartet in this music. Ethan Bronner, you want to run down the broker sort of status?
Sure.
From your perspective?
I think that, there is an outside shot for Turkey, which has been playing a role between Israel and Syria. And I think that what Jim says about the American administration is quite right, although, of course, we're on the cusp of a new administration. And it seems from at least the essays that have been written by likely advisors to the incoming administration, they are less eager to see division between Hamas and Fatah. And there is a lot of talk in these sort of papers that have been prepared about seeking some kind of ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and a reconciliation between Fatah, or anyway the Palestinian administration in the West Bank, and Hamas of Gaza. So it's pretty grim at the moment, but it does seem like in a month that could conceivably change.
Well, that's a lot to digest. Ethan Bronner, thanks so much for joining us, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times, and Jim Muir, our pal from the BBC, reporting from Beirut. Thank you, Jim and Ethan.
My pleasure.
Good to be with you.
Very much to digest. That's the first I've heard of Turkey being involved.
That would be a fascinating development, but maybe that's what it needs is someone else.
In a month, we may be in a totally different zone, as Ethan says.